So this is all basing on the other side where civilization started.
Right. Okay, well, hopefully we'll have people coming in. If not, we'll continue our adventure. This is the 10th Genesis class, and we're going to hopefully finishing up some of Genesis 9 and into 10 tonight. We have been working on some pretty cool ideas and kind of tracking some variations, and the place that we've been the last couple weeks is the flood. And before that, we were dealing with the ideas of Eden and trying to come up with time frames, and all these interesting, wonderful things have been going on. Now, as we've discussed already, the bottom line is that even with all the different variations of all the different details, it's not hugely important, the details. The fact that God made the universe, made people, they went out and did stuff, and we're going to end up with a fall, we're going to end up with a flood, and a line that's going to lead to Jesus. You know, Jesus is the point of everything. So all these little details that we talk about are not necessarily the point, but it's fascinating, and we want to fill in as many blanks as we can. Like, for instance, if we can get our mind around the tribes that are in Canaan, when they go into Canaan, we can figure out how that works. We can figure out why they had to do certain things. So all this information interconnects, right? So you get an attack from a modern, you know, anti-Christian person who talks about, you know, whatever they talk about, genocide or whatever involved in the Bible and this and that. And if you don't know this stuff, if you don't have answers for why certain things are written the way they're written, then you're just kind of staring at them. So there's a reason. Or someone says, you know, was, you know, Goliath just kind of really tall, you know, like it was sort of like David versus Shaquille O'Neal, you know. Or well, what's that like? You know, what is that all about? So it's nice to fill in those blanks. One of the things we're filling in is this, is the idea of the flood. And we talked briefly about the survivors, if you will, or the remnants of pre-flood civilization that we run into after the flood. And we have got several pretty major trains of thought going. One I really, really like is sort of the most tight and conservative, but just to summarize the scale of those ideas. The tightest and most conservative reading is the one where we have the ark and we have the people listed as the people on the ark, and that's it, and everyone else is destroyed. In that rendering, which is the most tight and conservative rendering, we still have answers for everything that we need to have answers for. For instance, God is doing certain miracles around this time frame, such as bringing the animals, such as making all the animals. You know, you wouldn't have a zoo and have it go on for hundreds and hundreds of days under really rough conditions and have all the animals live. So God has got to be protecting everyone. It says in the text that he seals up the ark himself. So this could mean that all the other boats we talked about would flood. Andy had mentioned the idea of open boats, but even if they weren't open, it could be so rough that God's seal on the boat's the only thing that keeps it alive, right? Certainly you're not going to flood the whole world with giant geysers combined with open heavens and downpours and all these other things without an upheaval, very dangerous weather conditions. If you watch floods happen on Earth and see films of floods and tsunamis and things like that, the devastation is massive, and they're minuscule, tiny little things compared to, you know, what we're talking about. So in this particular tight conservative reading, this line of the Nephilim is going to sneak through in one of those wives. And we were talking about this last time. Andy had brought up the idea of it. And it's out there. It's a good one. And the idea is that one of the wives, probably Ham's, obviously, because that's where things go south is Ham. But one of the wives, they're not described where they're from and who they are exactly. And so one of them could be from this other tribes, these other groups of people. Basically, one of them could be a relative of the Nephilim or carrying that genetics. Now, there's plus and minus to this theory. This is probably the theory that if I had to pick, I'd probably be on this team if I had to. But I don't have to be. I have like other options. There is a problem, and the problem seems to be when we track this remnants that they have things that show you who they are, and that is, for instance, giant size. So then, and Pastor Andy had made the joke that maybe Ham's wife was like 10 feet tall or something, which is true. But Noah might have noticed that, or they might have said something about that. So it's interesting. The concept is very interesting to me. Could she have what you might call a latent gene trait? Sure, like red hair or something like that, you know, that hides in a family. Suddenly there's this, you know, red-haired child or something like that. I mean, yeah, it's absolutely possible that could happen. The other option, which is a little bit less conservative, a little bit more open idea, sort of we'll call it a moderate position, is that as they do many times in the Bible, they describe places and families and groups by a single individual's name. They'll say blah 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 and it means a whole bunch of people, but it's named after the leader. And you would describe families in a lot of ways, and they do this prior to the flood within Genesis itself. They say things like this person had this person and this person and a lot of other people, right? And they're only giving us the names of the important figures. So that makes it quite likely, or possible at least, that there was quite a few people on the ark. The ark's large enough for a large number of people. And maybe we're getting those three sons, and Noah and his wife, and those three sons and their wives, as our named leadership individuals that are going to prove important to us later in our story. And a whole bunch of other people are there, other relatives, other kids, and things that aren't really important to our tracking. Maybe those three kids are the oldest or most important kids of Noah, the ones that are going to track later, and it's going to be very important to know what happens to them. We don't have all the answers to everything ever in the Bible, because if we did, it would be a billion pages long, you know, and that would be chapter one. So we really don't have that answer. And of course, the most liberal understanding would be that, well, almost the most liberal, this could be a regional flood, this could be a lot of people, there could have other been other people that weren't important, villagers, etc., in those groups. And that liberal reading would give us all kinds of opportunities for other hitchhikers and people to be involved. The most liberal reading, of course, is that we're still in the realm of what we would call parable. The parable reading concept, which is held by quite a few people out there, that this is all like mythological stories of giving us lessons. And the way they resolve that is when we get through all the sort of mythological stuff, we start to settle in to those shorter lifespans and everything begins to make a little more sense on a daily basis and we have names of places that exist. Then we transfer into real life. That's that position. In other words, this is like the story of how so-and-so was made, you know, like Paul Bunyan-y stuff. Literally, Paul Bunyan, wasn't he a giant? But anyway, Babe, there's no blue ox in here, but we can just kind of assume that since India's not that far away, there probably was a blue ox somewhere. But anyway, so that's sort of the scope of what we're at. And we have a way to have this work with just exactly, you know, what the text says, with the number of people, with the way that was structured. God's going to have to work some miracles with the animals. He's going to have to work some miracles with things moving about the planet. He's going to have to work some miracles with how those animals are able to repopulate. So if we go with the tightest, most conservative view, and we go with just that, then we have to make a lot of assumptions that God's going to do a whole lot of miracles, which is a great position for me. I love that idea because God does do a lot of miracles and always has. So that idea is not alien or bizarre to me at all.
I just had a brain explosion. You were talking about all the storms and stuff. You were talking earlier about what happened to all the water after the flood. What if there was so much wind and stuff that it actually emptied the oceans onto the land, and then when the flood settled, they went back into the oceans?
Yeah, you could have that. You could have the sort of like a major version of parting the Red Sea, like parting the whole sea. You could do that. Like I said, there's a plenty of options here involving God doing miracles, and we have to remember that He did already, prior to this story, He already created the entire universe. So the idea that, oh, that might be a too big or weird of a miracle is not really, it doesn't really exist, the idea. Well, that flood thing seems kind of weird. I know the whole, you know, Orion Nebula thing is cool, but, you know, it doesn't work like that. If you're going to buy the premise in the first place that God created the universe, then it's not going to be too hard for Him to flood a planet or remove the water later or whatever He wants to do. Maybe He has, like, you know, a giant God bounty that He just puts on the planet and quicker picker-uppers everything. Who knows? You know, who knows? God does what He wants to do, including, you know, coming down and burying Moses Himself and stopping the sun from moving for a minute and keeping the sun up for during one of the battles. I mean, things happen. Crazy thing. Feeding 600,000 people, or, you know, plus or minus, feeding all those people with random, you know, food from, you know, miracle food. There's a lot of miracles. So we can rest assured that other such miracles are possible. The reason I want to point this stuff out is just to kind of have vocabulary in your repertoire of this idea. And also, I found something that I think might be an indicator of the size. Now, we have, obviously, a variety of these people. Now, for people that say there's, like, only one example or two minor examples of this sort of remnant of this genetics or whatever, the answer is that's incorrect. There's a lot of scripture on this. I've got about the top 5 or 10 mentioned on the board in some place, but it's very specific. And the reason I wanted to give you these names is because they cross connect. If you look at Genesis 14:5, it's sort of where it all starts. And in Genesis 14:5, it says that in the 14th year, and this is Chedorlaomer, sometimes pronounced with a K, Chedorlaomer, and the kings that were with him came and defeated the Raphaim in Azrathoth Karnaim, and the Zuzim in Ham, and the Emim in Shave Kirathaim. Now that's the kind of stuff we skip. when we read the Bible, we're like, whoop, right over that, right? Because that's way too many crazy words. And we're just going to keep on moving. But this is a reference to the Rephaim. And the Rephaim are mentioned multiple times, and they're cross-connected. So if we jump over to Deuteronomy, and we'll just jump over to Deuteronomy real quick here, and we'll go to 2:11. We go over there to Deuteronomy 2:11. There we go, and you'll notice that in Deuteronomy 2:11 it says, "Like the Anakim, they are also regarded as Rephaim, but the Moabites call them Emim." So, like the Anakim, They are also regarded as Rephaim. Okay? So, Anakim. So now we're on to Anakim, right? So let's go to Deuteronomy 9. Well, while we're here, we'll go to 3:13. While we're right here. And it says, the rest of Gilead and all Bashan, the kingdom of Og, I gave the half-tribe of Manasseh, all the region of Argob, all of Bashan. This is called the land of the Rephaim. The Rephaim, okay? If you jump over to 9:2 in Deuteronomy, you'll notice that it says, a people great and tall, the sons of the Anakim, whom you all know and whom you've heard of, and you've heard that said, and this is a saying from that time frame, who can stand before the sons of Anak? The sons of Anak, the Anakim. The sons of Anak. So, we're tracking this idea of Anak and Anakim and Rephaim, which are also called Emim and Zemzemimim. I love this. This is a lot of M's and a lot of Z's in this word. Zemzemim. Okay, also known as the Zuzites, Anakites, and Emites. Now this is all important, okay? I'm gonna blow your mind, like your head completely off your body in a second, but we'll get to that. So what is all this about? So let's go real quick to Joshua 14:15. If you shoot over to Joshua 14:15, you get this. This is Joshua, right? Okay. And it says, therefore, Hebron, I'm going to go 14 first. Therefore, Hebron became the inheritance of Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, until this day, because he followed the Lord God of Israel fully. Now, the name of Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba, for Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim. The land had rest from war. Kiriath Arba means the city of Arba. Okay? Now, as you go through this, you discover that Arba is the father of Anak. So what we're getting, if you do the research and cross-reference for millions of years, you're going to discover that they're actually tracking a bit of a lineage for these Anakites and for these Nephilim sort of survivors or whatever. Now, all of this stuff is going to take place in the places that we're about to read about that are going to come under Ham's jurisdiction, right? So, this is why we can continue that train of thought. But let's take a look at Numbers. And this time, let's look at Numbers 13:33. That's one of the key passages of this whole research project. And Numbers 13:33 says, there also we saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim. And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight. And so we were in their sight. This is the key passage for this study. This is what happens. This is the spies' reports. You'll remember Moses, Joshua, all the guys are coming to view the land. They're getting ready to do this invasion, right? So they're sending spies into the land. And they come back, and everybody's wigging out. So we'll back up a little bit. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, I love Caleb. Caleb's cool, and said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it. So two people, Caleb and Joshua, are down because they know that God is with them. But the men who had gone up with him said, we're not able to go up against his people. They are too strong for us. They gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report, saying, the land which we have gone spying in, a land that devours its inhabitants, all the people we saw are men of great size. In some of the translations, it says giants. There's giants there. And then it says, we also saw, he says Nephilim. He says son of Anak or part of the Nephilim. And so we get the connection from the Nephilim to the Anakim. And we see Arba. And then Anak has three sons. Sheshai, Aimaim, and Talmai. And that's going to be important for this research, but we'll go 21:33 real fast in Numbers, which says, then they turned and went up to the way of Bashan, and Og, the king of the Bashan, went out with all his people for the battle of Edrei. when Edrei or Edrei is the battle that they're about to have with Og, and Og is one of these descendants of the Nephilim. He's one of these Anakim, okay? And the Lord said to Moses, "Do not fear him, for I have given him into your hand and all of his people in his land, and you shall do to him what you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites who lived in Heshbon." So they killed him and his sons and all his people until there was no remnant left him, and they possessed his land. Okay, so that's what happens to Og. But you'll see that we have a really, really cool passage about Og. Who's basically, so we just read how that's one of the kings, right, that they're going to fight. So this is Deuteronomy 3:11, and this is where, and I'll leave this after this a little bit behind, but I just want you guys to be able to track all of this. Deuteronomy 3:11, and you shoot over there and you read. So all the cities of the plateau and Gilead and all Bashan as far as Salakai and Edrei, the cities of the kingdom of Og and Bashan. And then 3:11 says, "For only Og, king of Bashan, was left, the remnant of the Rephaim. Behold, his bed was an iron bed. It is in Rebah of the sons of Ammon." Hold on, is that it? Yep. "And it measures 9 cubits. Its width is 4 cubits. And it's by an ordinary cubit." Now, this is the story of the king of Og and how they've taken the bed, right? So they have measured it because they've captured it eventually, right? And it's a metal bed. It's like an iron bed. So first of all, that's weird. Okay. But that's okay. You can pile a lot of furs on it or whatever. But the point is, they give us a measurement of 9 cubits long and 4 cubits wide. And as we discovered last time, we talked about the measurements of the ark. There's a variation in how you do these cubits. I haven't really got a good answer of what a common cubit is, but generally speaking, a cubit was the distance of a forearm, okay, of a man. So it can be anywhere roughly from about 17 to about 22 inches. So if we settle on that range, and it could be as much as 20, I think one of the guys last time had put it at 20.5, which would be like an average, right? I mean, we can do that. We can come up with it. But that gives us a range from 153 to 198 inches, or 12.75 to 16.5 feet long, and 5.66 to 7.33 feet wide. So Og's bed, who's called a Rephaim, which is one of the Anakim, which is the sons of the Nephilim, is about 15 feet by 6 feet. Now, we don't know what that means. Maybe a bunch of people slept in that bed. Maybe they slept sideways at that time. But the bottom line is, even with a few feet of comfort room, this guy's got to be 12 feet tall. He just got to be. And this is not what you would call human capability. So if we go 9 feet or we go 7, 8 feet, a lot of people have put these height of people like Goliath in the range of something like, 7 or 8 feet tall. Like, Shaquille O'Neal height. A big, giant guy for a human. There's reason to believe, primarily because why would all the warriors come back scared to death of tall people? They've seen tall people. And other people that have argued that, oh, well, the Israelites were kind of small, as slaves. They didn't get a whole lot of nutrition. I've heard this. This is funny. This is like, okay, whatever. But they didn't get a lot of nutrition as slaves, so they were kind of short. And these guys could have been like 6 feet tall, but they were going to be like 4 or 5 feet tall. I don't really think that they were 5 feet tall. Maybe they were 5.5 feet tall, but 6 or 7 feet is not enough to scare the warriors of God who've seen things like pillars of fire and smoke and parting of seas. When everybody's shaking in their boots except for one or two, God crazy people like Joshua and Caleb, it has to mean something. And when that whole army, and so we know Saul, okay, we know that Saul is, a completely awesome guy. We know he's big, We know he's handsome. We know he's a stud. I mean, this is a studly guy. This is the kind of guy you want to be your king. He's a man among men. He's a great warrior. And we've got all his warriors with him. And this one guy is calling them out. There, we can't possibly believe that Goliath was less than 6, 7, or 8 feet tall. We can't possibly believe that he was just a tall guy. If he stood a foot or two taller than Saul, Saul would have walked out there and chopped him down. He's got to be something so scary that Saul is shaking his boots, that all the Israelites, everybody is shaking in their boots. Even though they've won tons of battles, even though they know they have God on their side, how do you scare them? This guy has got to be huge. He's got to be like a tank. I mean, even when it is a tank, people still attack. You know, if you should study the, people make Polish jokes. And I always laugh when people make Polish jokes because I have a whole different comprehension and understanding of the Poles. And it has to do with 1939. In 1939, Hitler and the Blitzkrieg invaded Poland. And Poland was not ready technologically for this attack. And they had a cavalry that was actually horseback. And those guys mounted up and charged to defend their country against tanks. They knew they weren't gonna their spear wasn't going through the tank. I think they probably knew that, but that's how brave they were. So I like to tell that story in the middle of a party when people start to tell Polish jokes about. And I mean, sure, they have a submarine with a screen door, but that's really just a design flaw. I'm just kidding.
That's the way us Polish people design stuff, though.
You have to be able to get some fresh air.
If you're on the surface and there's mosquitoes everywhere,
you gotta have a screen door. No, but I usually interrupt and tell that story because the Polish people they're talking about some major bravery. The point is that those guys charge tanks on horses. The Israelites have God. You know what I mean? It doesn't make any sense. Unless Goliath is something so insane and so monstrous and so scary that you just can't get your head around it, right? Because he's taunting them. I mean, even macho, type stuff would have the guys go fight him because he's taunting them all the time for day after day, just making fun of them and their God and everything else. It's mind-boggling. So the only way that makes sense to me, that story makes sense, is if he really is a giant, if he's really insanely scary, like a fully armored 12-foot tall guy, 10-foot tall, whatever, but much taller than a human being. And then it makes sense. Everybody's like, I ain't going. You can go. You want to go? I'm going. Right? That makes more sense. But we're tracking that, and we can see it. Now, whether that came through somebody that survived the flood or whether that came through this line of one of the wives is up for discussion, but we get it. We've got a tracking of survivors, and we've got a bed size in the 15-foot by 6-foot range. I mean, that's just massive. That's a massive, massive bed. Anyway, if you read through Joshua and you read through all this other stuff, you'll find out. You'll see the description of the bed. You'll see this, how Arba and Anak are related. And the reason I wanted to tell you all that is to really blow your mind. Remember how we've been talking this entire time about how we would love to have different types of archaeological cross-referencing. Whenever they prove something, it's very, very cool. Well, they found one of Enoch's sons. Okay, so check this out. So archaeologists have discovered that the Sheshai, so his name is Sheshai, in the second intermediate period records, remember how I explained that the Hyksos, and it's on your charts that I sent out, the Hyksos period was in the second intermediate period, 1750 to 1650 BC. And it was when some Canaanites had taken over some parts of Egypt, right? And we had that period. Well, one of the kings, one of the leaders of that Canaanite incursion of the Hyksos period in the intermediate period is in the record, and his name is Sheshai. So his name is exactly the same, S-H-E-S-H-A-I in Anglicized Hebrew, S-H-E-S-H-I in Anglicized Egyptian, but it's Sheshi or Sheshai. And they have found, just a little bit away from Hebron, they have found a place that has an inscription in an older language between this one and that one that says Kiryat Arba. So they found the city of Arba. It's like a ruined area not far from Hebron. And they found what looks to be one of Enoch's sons mentioned in a king list as one of the conquerors of Egypt during that time. So just wanted to point all that out because that's super cool. We love it when we discover, you know, some cross-referencing from other cultures or some, you know, some type of archaeology supports the Bible. And the fact that we found that is really quite cool. So we've made it through the flood, and however we want to analyze the situation, we've either got a hidden, you know, genetic code in like Ham's wife, or we've got a survivor somehow. But anyway, in 9 we read that God blessed Noah and his sons and said, "Be fruitful and multiply." The fear and the terror of you, we read that part last time about how they're going to kind of take over the planet, repopulate the planet. And we discussed how, you know, that can seem odd, but we need to remember that there's been a whole lot of miracles that are a lot more strange than allowing that to happen. As we continue, God's going to establish a covenant with Noah. And we're in 9:9. "I myself do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature, and the birds and cattle and beasts of the earth." And the covenant is that he'll never cut them off like this again by the water of the flood. There'll never be a flood to destroy the earth again. And the sign of the covenant, that there's going to be a rainbow in the clouds. And this rainbow is going to happen, you know, during rainy times. But when we see this rainbow, we're going to know that we're going to remember that covenant, that he won't flood and destroy the world again like that. "And I'll remember my covenant between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and ever again shall the water become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the rainbow is in the cloud, then I will look upon it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature." And God said to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant between me and all flesh that is on the earth." Now the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem and Ham and Japheth. And Ham was the father of Canaan. So we get introduced to Ham as the father of Canaan right now. And it's when the other two guys are just mentioned without a caveat. So we know immediately there's going to be a problem. "These three were the sons of Noah, and from them the whole earth was populated. Then Noah began farming and planting a vineyard." Now, Noah's, you know, identify with Noah. You know, you've been through this flood. The first thing you want to do is, you know, plant some vineyards and make some wine. I can understand that. I think maybe, you know, Noah, since he was the holiest man on the planet, you know, I think he's probably... probably okay if he has a drink after, you know, after the flood.
If you see the world completely inundated with the flood, you just need a drink.
You need a drink. Yep. You just need a drink. Even if you have to plant it yourself, I can just see him waiting for the vines. Come on. It takes a couple of years. Come on. So anyway, so he gets drunk and he's uncovered inside of his tent. Now this passage that we're on right now has been discussed a lot among people. What exactly happened? What exactly does it mean? But this is what it says. It says Ham, the father of Canaan. Again, it says that. So we're just nailing this Ham guy to the wall, okay? Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. So this is a simple passage, but it kind of alters the structure of everything that's about to happen in the world. The way it works is, what we're supposed to infer from this is this is a bad thing. Okay, now here's how this looks. He goes in his tent, he sees his father passed out naked. OK, Okay, so Noah was getting down. Okay, he was drinking and he was buck naked. So that's pretty awesome. He was having a little bit of a personal party, and he deserves it. He saved the world. Okay, but when Ham comes in and sees him naked, he doesn't immediately respond by covering him up. He doesn't immediately respond by saying, "Hey, Dad, dude, you know your stuff is, you know." He doesn't do any of that. You know, like we would do. We would do something. We would throw a sheet over him or say something or whatever. We definitely wouldn't run out and tell everybody, right? So we're getting this feeling that Ham is not a good guy, right? So he's going to run out and say, "Hey, guys, man, you got to check this out. Dad's buck naked, passed out," right? Maybe he's trying to make himself look good. Maybe he's trying to make his father look bad. But this is not a cool move. And you see from the reaction of the other two brothers, Shem and Zephed, take a garment, they take a sheet or a garment, they stretch it between themselves, and they back in, they walk backwards in, and they cover their father up. So they're, you know, they're doing this backing in, kind of like, where am I at in the room? They've been in the room many times. Bump into the bed, okay, cover him up. Now this is like very, very respectful what they do. Okay? They're trying to not, you know, try not to look at their father in that way. They're trying to respect him. They're trying to cover him up so no one else can either. Their response is extremely respectful. And It's like they get it. It's like they get the whole point of the flood and the whole world and everything that's happened. And this is the one. This is the man that God chose. And so if there's a little hiccup, it doesn't change that fact. Right? It doesn't change who he is and how he's their father and how they have to respect him and everything. This could be the origin of how that works its way into the Ten Commandments, right? Because their reaction is one of very respect. They're honoring him. They're respecting him. Now here's an interesting thing. The next passage. When Noah woke from his wine, he knew that his youngest son had done what his youngest son had done to him. So how? Right? So in our world, you know, the way that we describe things, I would call that a word of knowledge, right? Maybe there's another reason. Maybe God, you know, but I think God shows it to him or says it to him or something. I don't know. But he knows what's happened. Now, he doesn't know that because he was awake, because it says he was asleep, and also they've covered him. So he doesn't wake up when, you know, Ham's there pointing at him and laughing or whatever. That's not what's happening. So he must have a word of knowledge. And if he gets a word of knowledge, we can assume that maybe he gets a little bit of insight into his son's heart and how he's kind of a cruel person, how he's kind of a person that like would make fun of people and do stuff like that, right? Because he says, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." So he's getting all this information from somewhere. None of that stuff exists yet, right? At least not in the way we perceive it now. May God enlarge Zephath and let him dwell in the tents of Shem and let Canaan be his servant. And then it says, Noah lived 350 years after the flood. All the days of Noah were 950 years and he died. Boom, dead. So that's the last thing. And it says he lived 350 years after the flood. So it seems to me that we just like did a 300-year hookup, right? Something like that. So we've got, they're settling on the land. God talks about the rainbow. He plants the wine and gets drunk and passes out. It's going to take at least a year or two to pull off the grape turn into wine thing. But because you've got to grow the grapes. And it could be as long as 10 years to get workable grapes out of seeds. It's going to take a while. I don't know. Maybe it was extra blessed because everything seems to be extra blessed. Maybe it happened quicker. But then, so maybe we're 10 years after the flood, but he lives 350 years after the flood. So we have got a 300-year hiccup right there where we get nothing but one sentence. Now, the reason for that has to be how important that moment was of, with those three sons and what happened. Because the reason it ends like that, the way it ends like that, is because that's how big a deal that moment was. And that curse, that kind of prophetic pronouncement that Noah makes. Because we jump immediately into the records of the generations of these three kids. And that's the main point of tonight, is to kind of walk through that. Because this is the kind of stuff we typically skip over. And it's just a ton of weird words, right? You're trying to read the Bible. You want some good juicy tidbit to help you with your day. And you get these lists of Gomer and Ashkenazites and Togarmah. And you're like, come on, right? And but this is going to be traceable. The reason it's in here, there's a reason for everything. And it's going to be trackable, right? Now, these are the records. And I'm reading right now from the NASB, and they all work. I use a New King James quite often. But now, these are the records of the generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and sons were born to them after the flood. The sons of Japheth were Gomer, and Magog, and Madai, and Zavin, and Tubal, and Mesech, and Tiras. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You know, he's got 6 or 7 kids, and then it jumps immediately into Gomer's kids: Ashkenaz, Riphath, and Togarmah. So we're getting a lot of generations quick. The sons of Javan were Elisha. Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. From these, the coastlands of the nations were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, and to their into their nations. So this is giving us like a breakdown. Now we can track this in two ways. Remember, we continue to have these sort of two tracks. Remember back in Eden, we had the idea that Adam and Eve were the first and only people on the planet. But then we also have the idea that in Genesis 1, people were created. In Genesis 2, the story of Eden was a separate, specific story. That got us these extreme ages, you know, these 900-year-long, 10 generations of 900-plus years, etc. And explained a lot of those things, like Cain's wife or whatever. So we have these two things we've been discussing. Well, when we read this, we've got two approaches. Approach number one is that every person that there is going to be is coming out of these people. Okay? And so, let's imagine that you have several wives and that all these people have multiple other wives. First of all, God's going to have to work a miracle concerning inbreeding. Okay? Now, we can assume that because he's worked a lot bigger miracles than you know, stopping inbreeding for a few generations, okay? But if you go with the other alternative, which was that we're getting the names of leaders and that there's a bunch more people on the boat, you know, and that could be possible. We've seen that in the text, so that's also possible. Then there could be hundreds of people. If Noah's 600 when the ark happens, and he's got three kids that are the main leaders, and there's a bunch of other people, a bunch of other kids, a bunch of other grandkids and great-grandkids and all these other people, there could be hundreds and hundreds of people on there. So, depending on how you want to approach it. If you do it by that way, then these things can be symbolic names. In other words, a guy can go into a region and take over, and there's people there. Okay, it's possible that there's survivors or people that had other boats or something, and he takes over. That's a possibility. Or they could literally have all the people. And we've got these long time frames of hundreds of years built into this story so that there's time to multiply. If you had a bunch of wives and a bunch of sons had a bunch of wives and it went on like that for several generations, it doesn't take long to build a large number of people. But that confuses some people and worries them, because by the time Abraham gets to Egypt, Egypt's a full-fledged country that's been in existence for a long time and has a long history, and giant monuments and stuff are there, like pyramids and stuff. So that's very confusing to people. Did they exist prior to this? Was the flood regional? Did something survive the flood? I mean, if you built the pyramid before the flood, it would survive the flood because it's a pyramid made of stone. So how does that look? And I'm not saying the pyramid was built before or after the flood. We really don't know. We've been trying to figure it out, you know, but it's unlikely that we're going to ever nail it down to the exact year. And, you know, in July 1st of 3017 BC, the flood rain started. That's going to be fairly unlikely that we're going to nail it down like that. But the bottom line is you're having a lot of kids. And once again, don't forget that the possibility exists here that only the important figures that do important things that we need to know about are being mentioned. You can't mention every single person ever. It would be a billion-page book. But you can mention everyone important that's going to involve parts of the story and how the story connects and the story of man with God and the story of how we get to Jesus. You can have all those connections built in and not tell the whole story of everybody else. You know, you can learn about Ruth and not learn about everyone else in that town, you know. So, this is possible. We keep going, but the way it's phrased with these nations, they're either taking over nations or they're building them from scratch. But they're a big deal, and they could be a big deal because they're the remnants of the line of Eden. They're the ones that are going to connect Adam to Jesus. So they've got special genetics. We talked about special genetics being tracked from the Nephilim. There's special genetics being tracked from Eden as well. They could be special. And that brings us to the funniest, you know, Pastor Andy comment. If Noah is tracked directly from Eden, and the way that Eden and the way that Seth and Cain and everybody got along in the world was because they were gigantic, and then the Nephilim came along and were making giants, who's to say everyone on the ark wasn't 12 feet tall? So you got Noah and his people that are all giants from Eden, and you've got, you know, some of the wives. This would be a reason, and I'm just, you know, whatever. This is just total speculation. But this will be a reason that his son might not care or know. You know, she might be short. She might be 11 and a half feet tall. She might be a little petite thing. You know, no idea. You know,
how tall was the ark?
Yeah, they got three floors on it, and how tall it is. I mean, hey, you could try to calculate walking around headroom. Yeah, you're probably going to get a pretty big amount of headroom, though. Anyway.
I still like Bill Cosby's comment about the ark, though. He's talking about the ark and all the animals and all this kind of stuff. He says, I just see this conversation between Noah and God. You know, they're on this ark, you know, all this time. All these animals are there. And Noah's saying to God, God, have you seen that mess down in the bottom of the ark?
Yeah.
How long are you going to make it stand?
Yeah, the ark's not going to be cleanable. You're going to have to just leave it. Wherever it landed, I think we'll find it sooner or later, because we just had to leave it there. You know? But anyway.
One group claimed they found it, you know, at one time.
Yeah.
The big timbers of the ark were still there, supposedly. Turkey or somewhere.
Yeah, Turkey.
I saw a thing about that.
National Geographic many years ago, back in the 60s, I saw aerial photographs on a mountainside in Turkey of the ark sitting in this glacier or the snow.
I don't think they really managed to pull that together, but I think it's a great idea. I think, you know, it's possible. But of course, it's made out of wood and pitch, so it probably didn't survive, but we'll see. Anyway, continuing 10:6, the sons of Ham were Cush and Mizraim and Put and Canaan. And the sons of Cush were Seba and Havilah and Sabta and Rama and Sabteca, and the sons of Ramah were Sheba and Dedan. And, you know, forgive my pronunciations. And Cush became the father of Nimrod. He became a mighty one in the earth. So this is our first sign that perhaps our tighter, more conservative approach might work. Because Nimrod, they use the term a mighty man, a mighty one, the same term that they used back when they were describing the mighty men of old that came out of the Nephilim. Okay? So it appears that possibly Nimrod might be a giant, or at least something along those lines. He's a mighty hunter, and it says in several places in several translations, that word mighty, they use the word giant. So he's described in several, including the Talmud and other Jewish texts, he's described as a giant. Now this is fascinating, because this comes from Ham, who has the curse, and from Canaan, and Canaan's going to be where all those remnant people are. So the Rephaim and all the Anakim and the Emim and the Zemzemim and all those guys are all in Canaan. And Canaan is coming straight from Ham right here. Okay, and it says that Canaan, Cush and Mizraim and Put and Canaan were the sons of Ham. And Cush is the father of Nimrod. So there's actually going to be these three. The reason I put these three sections is because there seems to be tribes of the Rephaim, which are the remnants of the Nephilim, inside of Canaan, which means that those tribes are all coming from different directions. So in other words, Canaan is one thing, but Cush, who's another one of Ham's kids, has Nimrod. So it very well could be that this genetic code is being carried by Ham's wife, who we have no knowledge of. It also...
Her name was Eggs.
Her name's Eggs. Ham and Eggs, yep. We know that he is jealous of his brothers because it's green ham, right?
Green eggs and
ham. So anyway, no, I'm just playing. Anyway, so Ham, being Cush, so Ham is Cush is Nimrod's grandfather, right? And Nimrod is going to figure into this whole story, because he's gonna be around when we get to the Tower of Babel section, right? So we've got this whole thing kind of coming up, but let's check this out. Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord, and it's been called a giant in multiple texts. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and we're going to recognize that name, right? And Erech and Akkad. Now this is a reference to that the A-K-K-A-D word I put on the board back in class 1 or 2. Akkadia or Akkad, or Akkad. There's a bunch of ways to pronounce these things because they're all in like five different languages. And it talks about the land of Shinar or Shinar, right? But this Akkad or Akkadian thing, this connects, because right there it says from that land he went forth into Syria. Now, Syria doesn't exist yet, but that's the area as it would be called later, and built Nineveh and Rehobothir and Calah. So these are cities. That's the city of Nineveh. That's the city that Jonah is going to be sent to later. So if you look up the city of Nineveh, you get a history that brings it back to almost about 3000 B.C., okay? And if you look up this reference to Sheshai, that's taking place later, and those are some generations. Of course, we don't know how long they would live, right? We don't have a bunch of information. But the idea here is that this makes that original idea of around 3000-ish B.C. for the flood, it makes it possible, right? And you can push it forward or backward a little bit. Like I said, everything is so dicey that far back. And Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, that is the great city. Mizraim became the father of Ludim and Anamim and Lahabim and Naphtahim and Patrushim and Kashlahim, from which came the Philistines. So now we've got another line coming from Ham, in which we know there's a giant. So we're getting a lot of support for this idea that Ham's wife is a secret Nephilim spy or whatever, right? However, she might not even know. Who knows what? But we have this trackable thing. Canaan became the father of Sidon, his firstborn, Heth and Jebusite and Amorite, and these are all the people they're going to fight later, right? And the Hivites and Arkites and Sinites and the Arvadites and the Zamorites and the Him. He's busy. And afterwards, the families of Canaanite were spread abroad. The territory of the Canaanite extended from Sidon as you go toward Gerar as far as Gaza. as you go towards Sodom and Gomorrah and Adma and Jobaim as far as Lasha. Now you can look all that up. That's all real. I mean, we found a lot of those places. A lot of those places still have the same name. Gaza still called the same thing. You know, we found most of those places. These are the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their languages, by their lands, by their nations. Also to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber, and the older brother of Zephath, children were born. The sons of Shem were Elam and Asher and Arpshad and Lud and Aram. The sons of Aram were Uz and Hul and Gether and Mash. And that's how we're going to get we're going to get connected to the Chaldeans and Abraham eventually. Arpshad became the father of Shelah, and Shelah became the father of Eber. Two sons were born to Eber. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. Joktan became the father of Almadad, Shelah, and Hazmareth. This is fun. And Zerah, and Hadaram, and Uzalal, and Diklal, and Obal, and Ibamel, and Sheba, and Ophir, and Havilah, and Jobab. All these were the sons of Joktan. Okay.
And then there was Lenny.
And Lenny
was like a cousin.
The reason we're doing this is because here it comes. Now their settlement extended from Mesha as you go towards Sephar, the hill country to the east. These are the sons of Shem, according to their families, according to their language, by their lands, according to their nations. These are the families of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies, by their nations. And out of these, the nations were separated on the earth after the flood. And then we're going to go into the Babylon. So here's something that we need to try to understand. Because as we track all this, we're going to get to Abram, right? And you're going to watch Terah, and you're going to watch Ur of the Chaldeans. You're going to see all this happen very, very, very soon, okay? That's going to come from Peleg, right? Oh. All of which is Shem's descendants. So we're going to see all that in a minute, like next class. But this is a hiccup, because it just said these are all the areas with all the different languages and all the different stuff. And then it immediately says, now the whole earth uses the same language and the same words. Now, this small little chapter, basically the first 9 verses of chapter 11, has caused a whole lot of trouble. And I have a feeling that it shouldn't. I don't know for sure, but I have a feeling that it's so small that it can't cause a bunch of trouble. And I have a feeling that we've been told that, because it just repeated over and over again. These are the descendants of so-and-so, and this is the languages and their nations and the lands. And this is the descendants of so-and-so with their own languages and the nations and the lands. It repeated it for all the sons. And now it says, and the whole earth use the same language and the same words. So we've got an issue. Either we're jumping back in time, or this is referring to a certain area, or there's a hiccup here of some kind. Yes, sir.